I am a little bit overexcited because, firstly, I've just watched a beautiful film called Playing with Sharks. Secondly, Playing with Sharks is the life of Valerie Taylor, Roland Valerie Taylor. And I feel like I'm an eight-year-old watching TV and there's a documentary with Ron and Valerie Taylor swimming with sharks and I'm like, oh, that's awesome. And now, you know, 60-year-old me is sitting with Valerie Taylor. So that's what I mean. I'm a little overexcited. Hello, Valerie Taylor.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you so much for coming in, and I'm very excited about this film. It's really, really beautiful and takes us back to an extraordinary time. It's back to a very different Australia, and it's as well as capturing your extraordinary life as well. Sally Aitken is the filmmaker who brought the whole thing together. Hello, Sally.
Thank you very much for having us, James.
Well done. I'll start with you. Valerie, I'll get to you. I'll start with Sally as to how... Like, did you know this story? Or I wonder if, as a filmmaker, you were so excited to find a story that had so much footage.
You have to be very careful what you wish for, James.
Yeah.
The credit really in that regard goes to producer Patina Dalton, who has known Valerie for a long time and who herself is a renowned natural history filmmaker and something of an archive hound.
Yeah.
And she had a light bulb moment a couple of years ago. There was a beautiful film made about Jane Goodall, which used a bunch of early footage of Jane in the jungle, and Tina suddenly thought, I know someone who's had first-hand observational experience of the natural world and had an incredible life. And so the film was really born out of the idea of combining, as you say, this extraordinary archive and the daring exploits of Valerie into a feature documentary. And, you know, of course, when you get a call that says, are you interested? It only takes a nanosecond to say.
Did you know Ron and Valerie Taylor? Did you know who they were?
I have to be honest and say, not in the extent that I do now. And one of the most extraordinary things, I think, is, you know, there was a film a couple of years ago also called Hidden Figures. And I feel like this is something of a hidden figures story for many, many Australians and also around the world. Valerie is beloved and known, but not for the influence and the ongoing advocacy for sharks. And
the
fact that she's still getting into wetsuits and going to Fiji and saying hello to her friends, the bull sharks cageless, you know. It was truly a journey of adventure and discovery for me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they were such a part of our lives, you know, and sort of, you know, such featured celebrities, I suppose, as well, into sort of perhaps the 80s, but perhaps not so much since then. Valerie, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, James.
Lovely to have you on. I'm so excited to meet a lady skin diver.
Really? Oh, I know a few.
You know a few. But I was so loving all those descriptions in the film, those sort of, you know, you're a lady skin diver, you're on the lady spear fisherman, you know, like as though this is a, you know, you're such an exotic mermaid kind of creature in your early years.
Well, in my early years, I had no competition. I was the spearo. I was the diver. I was on camera, and there was no other woman that I know of doing the same thing. And this was started in 1958 when a beautiful man in the same club came up and said, would I swim in front of his camera for him?
And that was Ron.
That was Ron.
Yeah. But you were active before then. Like you start, I think you say at some point you first put your head underwater at 14.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah.
A homemade mask, and I saw a piece of kelp, and that spent the whole time I was floating around until I got really cold looking at that piece of kelp in amazement.
I remember somebody called in at some point, and I remember being, you know, astonished at this, how much early scuba gear, skin diving gear, was homemade, that they made tanks and regulators and stuff themselves.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. So was Ron doing that? Were you doing that?
Ron made his own out of the bottles came out of an aeroplane. I think they were oxygen bottles. But mine was given to me by the man next door, who was a ship's chandler, and he was sent something called Heatherways from America. He didn't want it because it was a scuba gear. And he didn't have to return it, so he gave it to me because I was always down the waterfront playing and snorkeling, and I taught myself.
Yeah. And where did you grow up?
Well, when I was 3 and a half, we went to New Zealand. My father was to build a battery factory for Exide, and war broke out and we couldn't come back. So I was there, I was educated in New Zealand. And when the war was over, he finished off the battery factory and he came back to Australia, and we've been here ever since.
Right, right. And so you're all those early sort of, that very early footage is New Zealand footage.
No, I didn't know. Oh, the very, very early is my father.
Your father shooting you, yeah.
Yes.
And that's New Zealand?
That's New Zealand. That's right. 8mm black and white. They didn't even have colour in those days.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's it. Tell you, there seemed to be a lot of family footage as well, which is, you know, somewhat remarkable for that time.
Absolutely remarkable. It is no shadow of exaggeration to say we literally combed 7 decades worth of film footage, including, as Valerie says, her father's early home movies. And they were just a revelation, because you see a 14-year-old Valerie on the cusp of this extraordinary life. And I find them very moving and very beautiful when we cut them against the present date.
Yeah. Had you looked at footage from your childhood much? Had you seen it much?
No, only that bit. My father, I think we lost many roles coming back to Australia, and this is just one reel that was left behind. And I had a good friend in the industry remaster this old piece of film onto tape, I think, and it became useful. You never know.
You never know. But yeah, you do seem, like, even just the brief glimpses, you know, you're dancing, you're in costume and that sort of stuff, and it's like, there's a self-possessed young person. There's a strong person.
I had marvellous parents, particularly my mother, who believed that her children could do anything. She never had us christened. That was none of her business. And when I was 15, my mother said, okay, you're 15, you leave school, and on Monday you go out and get a job. Now, this is something that parents don't quite understand.
No.
I walked out the door, and the world was mine. Mm. I could do whatever I wanted. And I would say that feeling was why I was so successful on the stage, modelling, all the things I did, bandstand, things I did, because my mother had me believe I could do anything I wanted.
Right. I didn't know you were on bandstand.
Go-go dancing.
Go-go dance. Did you go-go dance on bandstand?
Only a couple of times. And and I sang a song.
What did you sing?
There's a hole in the bucket. Right.
Like, you get more, the longer I spend, I've only spent minutes with you and you're getting more awesome.
Exactly, James.
As it goes along. Exactly what it'd be like for you, Sally. If you want to join in, you know, perhaps you've got memories of Valerie, perhaps you knew her in the day, or you've been, you know, diving with her, or you want to jump on in, feel free to. The number is 1300 222 702. 0467 922 702. If you want to text us stories, if you're in the go-go dancing cage, I want a parallel. I'm seeing.
I wasn't in a cage.
Oh, you weren't in the cage.
I was with another girl inside.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know what to do, so I just copied them.
Right. Fantastic. Let's have a little listen to a grab from Playing with Sharks.
But no one's anxious to be slaving over a hot stove, least of all mermaid Valerie Hayes. Anyone who's interested in having their picture taken by a mermaid, just line up, please. When someone like Valerie comes down here with a camera, you can bet all the best-looking fellas will offer to pose for her.
The club used to have these trips, you know. Ron was there. I noticed him because I used to see him spearfishing. He was different to the other guys. Ron had won 4 Australian national titles and the world title at this time. He was the best.
There's a little description of Valerie meeting Ron, followed by preceded by the, you know, like, in my mind, I'm that broadcaster. I'd be that guy going, here's Valerie Taylor, a skillful lady skin diver, Dean Underwater. I would have so loved to do that. I was struck by, I suppose, that I'd forgotten this world of sort of spear fishing championships and that there was a competitive sport in that day.
Yes, it still goes on, sad to say. Mm. I don't have anything against somebody with a gun going out and spearing a tuna and bringing it home for dinner. But in a competition, you spear everything you can that's edible. And a group of, say, 50 spearos representing all the states can wipe out an entire reef system of big edible fish. Mm. And the fish you get on the reef live there. They're reef fish. Actually, it's much more courageous to go into open water and spear a big pelagic. And that's what I think it should be.
Yeah, yeah. It's true, isn't it? Like, take something for your needs, mm-hmm. but taking it for sport or to brag or to show off.
Oh, brag.
You know, yeah. The eye rolling there, it's palpable. I think you heard that eye rolling on the radio. Because it's also paralleled with the big game fishing of that era. So
yes.
it's something I was struck by, that sort of like, I could see Bob Dyer on a big speedboat with big game fishing, spear fishing, that sort of macho-ness and that sort of James Bond image of that sort of stuff. It was such a thing, wasn't it?
It was a terrible thing. I accidentally met up with Bob Dyer off a shoal bay. I saw him game fishing and there was a lot of dolphin around the front of the boat, and I snorkeled over and he had speared a dolphin for shark bait. Mm. And from that moment on, I hated him.
Yeah.
That's a terrible thing. And the idea is not to kill the dolphin, to mortally wound it so it's crying and calling for help. And that brings the sharks in.
That's awful.
And the other dolphin would have been trying to help their companion. A lot of game fishermen don't like this, but that was Bob Dyer. Yeah. Bob and Dolly.
We're talking to Valerie Taylor and Sally Aiken. The film's called Playing with Sharks. It's going to be it's premiering at Sundance, is that right?
It is,
yeah.
Yes.
That's exciting too, isn't it?
It's such an honour. And, you know, as I was saying to your producer on the way in, you know, actually, James, Valerie and I should be wending our way to America right now with Tina to be, you know, living at large. But yeah. We will be experiencing the festival, and the festival will be experienced online. And they're doing everything to create a really interesting platform, including, you know, virtual spaces and avatars. And yes, and it should be a great experience, and it's a terrific launch pad.
When do we get to see it here?
That is an excellent question, right. And it obviously depends a bit on how things roll out from Sundance, but never you fear, it will come to Australia, and hopefully the rest of the world will get to enjoy all of Valerie's exploits as Australians know and love too.
I mean, the other thing that must have been, I'll just talk about you in the third person for a moment, Valerie, excuse me, but the other thing that must have been interesting with working with Valerie is she is a filmmaker. She is completely across what it is you're trying to achieve.
James, it's remarkable that Adrian, the editor, and I are still unscathed, really.
Right.
No, we. It's a very interesting process, both with someone who has such knowledge of the ocean and her own life and the world of film. But interestingly enough, unlike every other documentary usually that Valerie has participated in, which is about something other, this one is about her. So it certainly led to some interesting conversations, didn't it, Valerie?
Yes. aren't they lucky? The virus was here and kept me away from the editor.
Right. Would you often have views on, would you say to Sally, I don't know why you put the camera there. I don't know what's this shot for? Why would you be doing this?
No.
No.
No, my husband didn't shoot anything that wasn't necessary.
Yeah.
I think that Sally had them shooting lots of things that I didn't think were necessary.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have a big crew to shoot our documentaries.
Mm.
And maybe Sally didn't have a big crew either, but to me it was. And we were very cautious about what we shot. Ron basically edited in his mind as he worked.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have a lot of money and we needed to do it as inexpensively as possible.
Mm. But it's also the difference with when you're using film, as you were mostly
yes.
in those days, and now you've got an endless sort of supply.
And so cheap.
I'd like to say, you know, in regards to the film, you have to remember when you are looking at the archival footage, Ron is holding his breath for most of those
right.
shots. We are not even talking about filming whilst on scuba.
Yeah.
You know, he would hold his breath, he would go down, he would shoot the scene and then come back and reload and do it all again.
Wow.
And so both the way in which the production has, you know, the means of production have changed and also that the ocean has changed, you know, are really evident in this, wrapped up in this film.
How long could you stay down for holding your breath?
When I was spearfishing, I probably averaged a minute to a minute and a half.
Mm.
Ron probably averaged 2 to 3 minutes.
Wow.
But he, because of film, and it ran out in a couple of minutes, and it had to come up and reload, rinse yourself off in the boat and reload. It was easier to do it if you were holding your breath. You could get in and out of the water faster.
Right, right.
We only use scuba for waiting for sharks, generally speaking.
Right.
That wasn't a thing you'd go in and shoot and get out again.
Yeah.
Impossible.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd just sit there and chum and bait and wait.
Yeah. Chum and bait and wait. That's my expression for the rest of the day. We're going to chum and bait and wait.
And then play.
Peter, thanks for calling in. You met Valerie and Ron?
Yes, I had the pleasure of meeting Valerie and Ron at Seal Rocks in 1971. I was fresh off the boat, so to speak, and was with my young wife and I. We were in a combi. We pulled into the campground there, and it was an unusual combi because it had California license plates on it.
Right.
And the next thing I know, we were approached by Ron to join them at their barbecue.
Mm-hmm.
And Valerie, I questioned what they were doing, and Val and Ron told me they were filming sharks off Seal Rocks. And Val gave me a tip that I've heard her say on the radio since, how to deal with sharks when they approach you, which I've had to use once only. Thank
okay. goodness
for that.
And what's the tip?
She said to me that they were a pack animal. If you eyeballed them, treat them like a dog, providing they weren't too big, you could control them. Christmas Day, 1987, serving Kingscliff beachfront. I had a very large shark surface right next to me, and we both sat there looking at each other for a couple seconds, and then he decided he better go, and okay. I decided I better go as well.
And so you used the power, you channeled the power of Valerie to move the shark off.
I've heard her say the same thing on the radio a couple other times in interviews, and since I met her that time, I actually didn't know who the Taylors were, and I told my friends when I got back up to Noosa about my experience meeting this couple.
Mm.
And my friend Bob McTavish, who was an old mate, said,
yeah.
That's the Taylors. You'll see them on TV.
That's the Taylors, mate. You met the Taylors. Peter, thanks so much for calling in. Is that true? That's not a sort of shtick that you have about sharks.
No.
That is how
no.
to deal with sharks.
Well, no predator expects its potential prey to swim towards it, looking at it, or just stay still and stare at it.
Right.
It puts them off a little bit. The only shark I've been with out of the cage is a great white that will not take notice. It doesn't care how much you stare at it and look at it. It just looks at you as a potential food.
Mm. It knows it's bigger and uglier than you.
Yes, and it's conditioned to eating larger marine creatures, whereas, say, the grey nurse, well, it wouldn't hurt anyone anyway.
Mm.
It's conditioned to eating fish.
Yeah. Tell me about the transformation from hunting and spearfishing into suddenly seeing this as a, we need to conserve these, we need to just use the camera. And do you think, you know, I would see you as one of the first people to say that to us, to the rest of Australia, to the rest of the world. You know what? We're going about this the wrong way.
Ron and I were at Maroochydore, and we'd each won our Australian titles.
In spearfishing.
and spearfishing. And we were looking at all these thousands of dead, beautiful fish lying on the sand. And Ron said, do you know that island out there, that coral reef, we've just taken every edible fish off it. And I said, yes, it worried me. Mm. We both won and we walked away and we never did it again.
What was the source of that worry, do you think?
Well, we were getting to like fish, to realise that they all had different personalities. Even in the same school, there were different personalities, that they could think ahead, that they would get to know you. And they were more like little land animals, very much the same, with the way they reacted to us underwater. And it would be like a possum coming up to say hello and you put a bullet in its head.
Mm.
We just stopped.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't make us very popular with the Spearfishing Association, but it made us like probably the first conservationist for the marine environment that I know of.
Because but it also puts you then into you're making biological observations there, aren't you? Yeah, you're
absolutely
making that's you have had the experience that this is a scientific observation. These things respond to us. We've seen them do this. This is you've moved into that territory.
Yes, and the thing about having been a champion spearfishing lady is that I can talk about it because I was there and I did it. And I did it for several years, and I did it successfully. So I have the ability to talk about things that no other woman that I know of in the world has seen and done. And I've used that as the first step up the ladder of trying to get more and more of the marine world protected because, as you know, we all come from the sea.
Yep.
If the ocean dies, we do.
Yeah. Yeah.
That'll be that.
And we're somewhat there. There's, you have a marine park named after you. We have a different attitude to sharks now, don't you think?
Some people do and some people don't. And a marine park is just that. It has to have another word in it to protect the area, a marine national park. I mean, they had the Australian Spearfishing Championships a couple of years ago in the marine park of the Great Barrier Reef. Mm. So it doesn't mean all that much.
Yep.
I wish someone would explain it to me.
Yep.
But I think those two words satisfy the general public. The fact that, oh, it's a marine park, the Great Barrier Reef is safe. Ha.
Yeah, yeah. Do you look at what's happening to the oceans now? I suppose I'm referring now more to plastics, to the rubbish that's in it. How does that make you feel?
Sick. It's terrible. In the early 70s, I crossed the Pacific with my husband all the way to Chile and island hopped all the way and it was pristine. 4 years ago, I did the same thing. Even islands that were uninhabited, the beaches were littered with plastic and garbage and rubbish and foam and I thought, what hope is there? There's nobody living here. This has come from somewhere. Countries like Indonesia, where they don't have a collection for the rubbish on most of the islands or any of the islands except Bali that I've seen, and that's not very good. What do the people do in the villages? They throw everything into the sea.
Mm.
That was all right when it was just coconut palms and banana skins. Now it's plastic, 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 and it's horrible.
Mm. Do you ever not see plastic now? I mean, I snorkel a little bit and you always see bottles and plastic bags and cans.
Just about always, I always pick it up around here, and I know other snorkelers and spearfishermen and divers, or the whole three of us, we will pick it up.
Mm.
Nobody likes to see plastic down there in a pristine environment. But there's only so much you can do.
Mm. How often do you dive now?
Well, I'm not diving at the moment because you generally do 3 trips a year to Indonesia. The last trip I did was in February, and that was to Papua New Guinea, Milne Bay. And that place used to be one of our favourite areas for wildlife, underwater, and filming. Didn't even see a shark.
Wow.
Didn't even see a big fish. The Chinese had been through, and they take everything.
Yeah, well. Yeah, we're at a strange point, aren't we? You know, when I hear you say that, I feel a chill, you know.
But so you should.
Mm.
Right now, because of the virus and countries like Chile don't have the means to chase the Chinese away, they're off the coast, they're all around the Galapagos, they're all around Cocos, they're everywhere. And they've got the biggest fishing fleet in the world, huge, and they're just raping the ocean, and we're going to pay a terrible price.
Yeah.
I don't think the human race in general gives enough thought to the importance of over 60% of our planet, and that's the ocean.
I watched the Attenborough film on you know, his testimonial to his life observing nature, you know, not dissimilar to yours. He finishes on a positive note, which is, you know, it's reassuring. And I suppose we've seen a little here with Sydney Harbour and some of the rivers. The way, if you stop messing it up, it does come back, you know.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
The Barrier Reef, if you leave it alone, will come back to normal. In 1967, Ron and I swam underwater the length of the Barrier Reef. It took 6 months, 2 days, filming in 35 millimeter all the way. And we saw reefs as white as snow.
So bleaching then, right.
And then we built our own boat and in 1982 went to some of those same reefs. Beautiful. Nature healed them, fixed them.
Right.
She knows what to do. Unfortunately, us humans haven't a clue. We can't build a reef.
Yeah. Sally, what's the film about, do you think, at the end of making it? What's Playing with Sharks about? Is it a biopic or is it more than that?
It's a film that has many different layers. I think it's a film that illustrates a life lived with purpose and passion. Obviously, it deals with the natural world. You'll learn things that you never knew about sharks. You'll certainly learn things through Valerie's eyes that you never knew about sharks. You will see gobsmacking scenes. And I'm talking a relationship that Valerie has with these predators that most people, you know, they're just too afraid to get close. And Valerie leaned in. So it's a film about a life. It's a film about a world. And it's a film that I think all of us can look at and realise that we all have a part to play, because the planet is interconnected. And as one of Valerie's contemporaries says, you know, you only have to look at Valerie. What an accidental conservationist we have.
Yeah.
And how grateful and lucky we are that happened.
What an incredibly effective one and powerful one as well.
Absolutely.
You know, like, it's a wonderful thing. Look, a fantastic conversation, and we didn't even get to Jaws, which is...
I congratulate you.
Really? But it's like that middle part of the film that's about Jaws is also, like, astonishing. I'd forgotten how deep your involvement with it was and how extraordinary that footage is, but fantastic. The film is called Playing with Sharks. When we'll see it, we don't know, but look out for it. Life and Times of Valerie Taylor, made by Sally Aitken. Sally Aitken, thank you so much.
Thank you, James.
And Valerie Taylor, what an honour. Thank you.
Thank you.